KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, inmates are ending their three-week hunger strike. What do they accomplish? And will there be any substantive changes in California's high-security prisons? Plus, he thinks outside the box, but is the mayor of Lancaster, California, an innovator or a racist?
The facts tell us that you cannot overburden a neighborhood with too many poor people, because then you end up with a project, you know, and all the crime and ramifications of that.
Also, Oakland takes a page from American Idol, a local singing competition to inspire teenagers toward careers in the entertainment industry.
My dad, well, he was a rapper, but he didn't take it really far. And I decided when I was 14 that I wanted to take it farther than he did, and I wanted to make it my life.
It's the California Report. Well, inmates throughout California prisons are eating now, winding down a hunger strike that lasted 3 weeks. The strike began at Pelican Bay Prison in Del Norte County. Prisoners protesting conditions in the Security Housing Unit, or SHU. But it soon spread to thousands of inmates at more than a dozen prisons. Michael Montgomery is a reporter with KQED and California Watch. He's been covering conditions at Pelican Bay and other high-security prisons for years, and he joins us now. Michael, first of all, you visited this isolation unit, the SHU. What's it like?
Well, the units are bleak. There are no windows. The inmates really don't have any regular access to the outside, except on television. And the inmates are in these isolation units 24 hours a day. They're allowed out of their cells to shower and to exercise. But again, the exercise area is really just another concrete pen with no windows. So it's not a nice life.
And how long can they stay in there?
Well, some of the inmates at Pelican Bay State Prison have been there in the isolation units since the prison opened. It opened in 1989. Now, the department says that that is necessary, that these are gang leaders, they have to limit their communication, and that they're dangerous people.
These gang leaders, tell us a little bit about them, and how did they orchestrate something like this from inside a high-security facility?
Well, the Security Housing Unit was built to cut off these gang leaders from communications to the outside world. It hasn't always worked. Some of these people are very clever. In fact, one of the strike organizers was involved in ordering a crime while locked down at the Security Housing Unit. So the department, again, says that that is a case where they really need to isolate these inmates. The problem is that not all of the men locked down in the Security Housing Unit are gang leaders. Some of them have very tangential connection to the gangs, and they've been put there merely for evidence of gang affiliation. That's something that advocates want to change.
So this hunger strike, it was a big deal. What do you think these inmates accomplished in doing this hunger strike?
Well, it was a big deal, and it was of concern to the department. You had groups that are normally divided, both race and by gangs, come together, and it was a sort of show of force. If you look at the accomplishments, they didn't really get any major concessions from the department. Their key demands would be major changes in how the department runs these units and who they put in isolation. But they did get a few apparent concessions, winter caps, calendars, perhaps photos of families, and maybe telephone calls, perhaps.
Well, Carol Strickman is an attorney with the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition. She represented the inmates in talks with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And she spoke Friday morning at a press conference in Oakland, and she described how the inmates see this.
In their view, the hunger strike was successful because it has brought CDCR into the open regarding its torturous and barbaric practices in the SHU. And secondly, it has boosted a growing movement for the rights of prisoners.
And Michael Montgomery, Carol Strickman did say that the inmates feel that there will be bigger changes coming down the road. How realistic is that?
Well, the changes they're talking about is reducing the length of time inmates spend in these units and perhaps changing how and why inmates are sent into these units. It's unclear. The department's looked at these issues before. There were a set of recommendations issued a few years ago. Those didn't go anywhere. So I think it's very much an open question. However, the department says they have made no promises to the inmates.
Well, in fact, I spoke Friday morning with CDC, our spokeswoman, Terry Thornton, and she actually denied that striking prisoners were promised any comprehensive changes. Here's what she had to say.
Our existing policies and procedures related to the security housing unit and gang management have really been refined through the fires of litigation. However, it has been a while since we've looked at some of these issues, and this is really a good opportunity to do that.
So, Michael, obviously a little bit of a disagreement there between what the prisoners think they're getting and what CDCR is promising. Where do things go from here, do you think?
Well, what groups who supported the strikes, the strike are saying is that this has created public awareness of the issues. They will continue to push it. There may be some litigation that they'll look for, some cases that they think could force the department to change its policies. We'll just have to see. But one thing the supporters are saying that is if the department does not deliver on what they say or promises, there may be more hunger strikes in the future.
Is there a chance that CDCR could actually hold this against the inmates, the fact that they started this very disruptive hunger strike?
Well, the prison officials have said very clearly that they see the hunger strike as something having been organized by prison gang leaders. In theory, inmates who participated in the action could be accused of participating in gang activity, and that could be used as a count against them to send them to the security housing unit if they're not already in there.
All right. Michael Montgomery, he's a reporter with KQED and California Watch. Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
The Los Angeles County suburb of Lancaster has some serious problems, including high rates of unemployment and home foreclosure, and more than its share of violent crime. Well, now, as LA Bureau Chief Chrissy Clark reports, Lancaster's outspoken mayor is trying to remake his troubled city, with plans ranging from the innovative to the possibly illegal.
Mayor R. Rex Paris is a wealthy trial lawyer who happens to look a lot like Kenny Rogers. Here's one of his projects to make the suburban desert town of Lancaster a better place to live.
It's there. You hear that?
He's piping this music for several hours each day through speakers along a half mile of Lancaster Boulevard. On your way to the bank, to the frozen yogurt place, water trickles, winds whisper.
And then a very subtle, very, very subtle birds in the background. And all of that is designed to lower our stress levels. You know?
Paris thought this plan up early one morning after he watched a video about how certain sounds make people get along better and shop more. Paris loves this stuff.
I'm a science guy. I get up at 4 o'clock every morning and I read it every day.
In fact, Lancaster is a bit like the mayor's personal laboratory, where he tries out theories that catch his eye. Theories like, what if we make city staff take Mandarin lessons to lure Chinese investors? What if we turn foreclosed homes into health clinics? And then there's this experiment.
Mayor Paris.
Thank you. Honorable board, I have a PowerPoint. It's
at a recent L.A. County Board of Supervisors meeting, Paris brought charts and graphs to explain it.
Look what we've done.
On one slide, a red line zigzagged across the screen. That was crime in Lancaster. Then the mayor pointed to a blue line.
But look at the statistics in regards to Section 8. They track.
Section 8 is the federally funded housing program that subsidizes rent for low-income families. Over the last few decades, the number of Section 8 participants in Lancaster has grown to more than 2,000. Some families moved from more urban parts of Los Angeles County, and Mayor Paris argues they brought with them a lot of the gangs and crime associated with those places. Turns out this theory, too, was inspired by some pre-dawn research.
You know, the Atlantic Monthly did an amazing article on how Section 8 was a major crime generator. Crime just blossomed in the suburbs, and we're able to attribute it directly to Section 8 housing.
The mayor took that article to heart. He's publicly declared war on Section 8. He says the number of subsidized houses is crushing their community. He has a special task force to reevaluate the Section 8 program. He's hired extra Section 8 investigators to step up compliance checks and, quote, remove the criminal element.
Section 8 is a plague on our city. In fact, I'm toying with the idea of putting up a billboard saying, do not come here if you're on Section 8.
And he has plenty of support. The city council backs him. There's a special part of the local newspaper just for articles about Section 8. A recent poll showed it was one of the top concerns in the city. And if you go down Lancaster Boulevard asking about it, you hear something like this.
Brings crime and not the kind of people you really want living next door.
Anytime they move in, they run down the neighborhood.
They don't take care of their homes.
The gangs are coming up from L.A., you know, the bad influences.
The mayor and his supporters are quick to point out that crime has dropped by double digits since the city started vigorously monitoring Section 8 homes. But others in town say that version of events leaves some important things out.
The real reason that crime has decreased in the city of Lancaster is we have doubled and almost tripled the number of deputies that are on the street at any given time. Period.
That's Darren Parker with the local branch of the NAACP. To qualify for Section 8, a family has to go through rigorous background checks, and some housing experts say they're actually less likely to break the law. Parker argues the campaign against Section 8 isn't really about crime at all. It's about race.
We have some city leaders who are using the tools at their disposal to go after a multitude of African Americans.
You see, in Lancaster, which until recently was a very white place, around 70% of Section 8 participants are African American.
This morning, we're filing suit against the city.
Earlier this summer, the NAACP joined with other groups to announce a lawsuit against Lancaster
for perpetuating racial harassment and discrimination that has been outlawed for half a century.
The suit claims the city's crackdown on Section 8 violates the Fair Housing Act, creates a racially hostile environment, and disproportionately impacts poor people of color. Here's one of the co-plaintiffs. She's asked to be anonymous.
Judy Doe. I failed to say my name because me and my kids, I feel we're already in danger.
Doe's family receives a Section 8 subsidy. She's a single mom with five kids, one who's mentally retarded. She moved her family to Lancaster from a rough neighborhood in L.A. 4 years ago.
For a better environment, better schooling for my kids, and to show them it's a different life.
Doe says she loved living here until some people found out she and her family received housing assistance. Then, one day, one of her sons was walking to school.
Car full of people drove past and threw pee on them. Urine and said you Section 8 dirty and threw it on them.
Other reports of harassment connected to Section 8 made news.
Disturbing case of racial hatred. A family on federal housing assistance was targeted.
The people living in this home say they were shocked when they walked outside this morning and found a racial slur scrawled on their garage.
I understand it is horrible for the people affected.
When I asked Mayor Paris about the claims of harassment, he said he felt bad, but he defended his campaign.
These jerks come out and want to call me a racist. Well, they can kiss my butt. There's the facts that we should look at. And the facts tell us that you cannot overburden a neighborhood with too many poor people, because then you end up with a project, you know, and all the crime and ramifications of that.
Speaking of facts, there is a footnote to this story. Remember that Atlantic Monthly article that inspired Mayor Paris to connect crime to Section 8?
That being the source of, quote, evidence for a public policymaker makes my stomach turn.
George Gelster is a housing expert at Wayne State University, and his research was widely cited in that article. But he says it was also widely misunderstood. Gelster says that the mayor's right, that crime rates tend to be higher in spots with concentrated poverty, spots where poor families make up around 20% of homes. But in Lancaster, Section 8 families make up less than 2% of homes. Plus, he says there are so many other factors that affect crime.
And without a lot more information and careful analysis, we could be unfairly stigmatizing a whole group of folks that are simply trying to find a better quality of life for themselves and their children.
In fact, making a better life is the goal of many of the changes in Lancaster these days. The question is, how do you do it? And who gets to define what's better? For the California Report, I'm Chrissy Clark in Lancaster.
Lots of teenagers dream of striking it big in the entertainment industry, but short of getting on American Idol, how do you do it? Well, last weekend in Oakland, volunteers hosted an open mic contest with critique from music industry pros. Reporter Caitlin Esch attended the city's Late Night Live program and has this story.
Next artist coming up, Tab Danger. Give it up, y'all.
Tyrone Dangerfield, or Tab Danger, is a tiny 16-year-old with a big personality. He struts around a makeshift stage in an East Oakland gymnasium. His friends dance wildly along. He wants to be a hip-hop star, and he's even started his own record label.
One of my producers was saying, think about a fairy tale. And immediately I thought about Cinderella.
Tab is one of eight teenagers singing his heart out in front of a panel of judges. He performs an original song.
The chorus goes, you want to sing the whole song?
Yeah.
It goes, hey Cinderella, don't you listen to them fellas who say dreams don't come true. Just forget about what they tell you. Grab your glass slipper.
We gon' have a blast. Let's focus on the present.
We gon' have a blast.
Hey Cinderella.
Tab has the confidence of a grown man, and he's determined to make a name for himself in the music industry.
My dad, well, he was a rapper, but he didn't take it really far. And as a kid, I always wanted to be like my dad. But I decided when I was 14 that I wanted to take it farther than he did, and I wanted to make it my life.
You're precious, the stone, Sierra Leone, starlight, star bright, make a wish for the first star you see tonight.
Ryan Peters is the director of Youth Movement Records. YMR is a mentoring program that organized the event with help from the Grammy Foundation, the Mayor's Office, and the Oakland Unified School District. Peters works with Tab and says kids breaking into the music industry need successful young role models.
When I was young, you know, I was always looking for the next mentor. And I didn't want to talk to old people. I just didn't. And for me, of course, in high school, old people were like 27.
Can I hear y'all say LLDB?
16-year-old Alexis Johnson goes by LLDB, or Lil Lex Da Beast. She sways across the stage and pulls the mic close. She started rapping a few years ago when she was living in a homeless shelter in Berkeley.
A lot of people in Oakland wasn't living right at the time. They was more worried about killing each other than living a life. And I did not want to be a victim or a suspect of anything like that.
So she channeled her energy into writing music and performing.
Yeah. By me showing my face in concerts, performances, and getting on stage, it just released all the stress and just free myself from everything that's going on and helps me stay focused towards what I want to do in life.
LLDB has big dreams. She wants to go to college, pursue a career in music, and ultimately work with young people in Oakland. This neighborhood has one of the highest high school dropout and unemployment rates in the city. Guards stand at the front door waving metal wands over everyone who enters. But once inside the recreation center, street life fades away. The kids loosen up. They're dancing and smiling.
Let's go.
Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan says she feels like a proud mom watching the performances. She says more police in the streets won't necessarily improve the lives of young people. It's about providing them with opportunities.
It's much tougher to not give up on kids. It's quite frankly, I think, a cop-out when the tough guys say, okay, we're just going to arrest these kids. It's much tougher to try to win over their hearts and get them to dream again.
The judges are locally known players in the music industry, including current award show competitor and kid band Pop Life. They cast their votes based on songwriting and showmanship. They compare notes and choose the best performer.
All right. The winner of the first Late Night Live event is Mr. Tab Danger. Give it up for Tab. Yeah. That's right. Tell your daddy.
Tab Danger is now in the running to perform at Oakland's Art and Soul Festival in August. But first, he'll have to compete against the winners of the next five talent contests.
Give it up for Tab Danger.
For the California Report, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Check out a video of the kids in action. It's on our website, californiareport.org. Well, now we go from song to dance. And if you've ever seen the popular TV show Glee, you know that one of the characters uses a wheelchair. Artie is his name. And Artie is always part of the choreographed dancing. Now, that might seem like a Hollywood fantasy, but in fact, wheelchair dancing is actually hot in more than 40 countries. KPBS reporter Kenny Goldberg paid a visit to the first wheelchair dancing program in Southern California.
You don't have to be able to walk to trip the light fantastic.
One, two, three, keep going. Nice. Don't forget to look at your partner. Don't look at their feet.
Inside a hall near downtown San Diego, seven people in wheelchairs move counterclockwise around a big circle. Seven able-bodied dancers are by their sides. Instructor William Valencia stands in the middle. Today, he's showing them the waltz. He offers pointers to the wheelchair dancers.
Don't let the wheels go, so use your abs. Good, now your arms so far. You're too tight in your arms.
And to their partners.
So, left foot. Sharon, left foot. That's your right foot. Two.
All of the dancers look like they're having fun, especially Isaac Whiting. He's 30, and he discovered the class about a year ago.
I've always wanted to go out into the public and meet other people like me, and I knew in the back of my mind that obviously people in chairs can do more stuff than people say they can do, but I've just never heard about wheelchair dancing, so I wanted to go out and try it.
Beverly Wording co-founded the wheelchair dancing program with William Valencia. She says it's the first one of its kind on the West Coast. Unlike some of the others here, Wording used to be able to walk. In fact, she used to love to go dancing. But about 15 years ago, Wording was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, and that changed her life.
I found myself not able to go upstairs. I was falling. Life became so uncomfortable. And finally, I had to find myself in a wheelchair. And for a year, I stayed at home. It was like a tomb. And I didn't want my able friends to see me in a wheelchair.
Wording says she snapped out of her funk when she came up with the idea of starting a wheelchair dancing class. It took her a year to find a dance teacher willing to take on the task. That was William Valencia. He spent months figuring out how to apply dance techniques to people in wheelchairs, and he learned how to move around in one himself. With the support of a local hospital, Valencia launched his first class in February 2009. Since then, Valencia figures he's taught about 250 wheelchair dancers in a couple of venues around town.
So I enjoy teaching them. I enjoy working with them. Love learning about their personalities, their experiences, how they do certain things, and the courage they have. So I think they're very strong people.
Liz Clarno is a lead recreation therapist at San Diego's Sharp Grossmont Rehab Center. She says through dancing, people in wheelchairs can increase their strength, endurance, and flexibility.
And then just people that are able-bodied, that are volunteering to dance with them, they interact and they begin to see people in wheelchairs as people.
As the dancers move around the room, they execute spins and turns. They look graceful, even elegant. Beverly Wording says that's what it's all about.
And when people see us dancing, they forget that we're in a wheelchair. So we're dancing on our wheels, but it's beautiful. And it's so wonderful for people like myself. It gives us a whole new feel of confidence and something different in our life.
William Valencia hopes to extend the program to wounded veterans in the near future. He'd also like to bring it to other cities in the state. For the California Report, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
Give your partner a hand, guys. Excellent job. Excellent.
And finally today, from San Diego County, the city of Imperial Beach this weekend is hosting the U.S. Open Sandcastle Competition. You heard me, Sandcastle Competition. But as you might imagine, these are not the typical sandcastles you see kids make on the beach. In fact, the annual event attracts several hundred thousand visitors each year. Reporter Stephanie O'Neill has the scoop.
Don't get too deep when you're digging because you don't want that real coarse sand because it doesn't pack worth the being.
In the days leading up to what's billed as the nation's largest sandcastle competition, there's often an odd spectacle here on the beach. Adults like Phil Benham of San Diego playing in the sand. And unlike the kids around them, Benham and his partners take on the task with adult-sized gusto and super-sized tools as they practice for the weekend competition. Each team member takes turns lugging 5-gallon industrial buckets full of seawater and dumping them over large piles of sand. Other teammates practice slamming the sand with steel-headed shovels to compact it well enough to hold its shape throughout the 5-hour competition.
The key ingredient is compacting the wet sand. That's it in a nutshell.
If you don't have enough water, if you don't have enough compaction, then the sculpture will dry up and disintegrate right before your very eyes.
Benham's teammate, Shirley Nakawatazi, is an Imperial Beach native and local accountant. She participated and won her first sandcastle contest back in 1967. She says the judges look for teamwork and originality, something both she and Benham produce in spades. Benham, an aerospace engineer, has been on no fewer than 16 champion teams. His favorite winning designs include a tribute to California's famed Route 66.
And it had a mock-up of Las Vegas, the Rockies, and then coming out in through Barstow. And all the little cars had little creatures in them. That was a nice one. We did one chilling out, which was a bunch of floating icebergs with penguins and seals laying out with sunglasses and laying in the sun. That was a nice one. Shirley, which have been some of your favorites?
One of my all-time favorites was so cool. They built a turtle, and they put little periwinkle shells all over on the top for scales, and it was beautiful.
This year, she, Benham, and the CPAs in her accounting firm have bumped things up a notch by going pro with sponsorship from Subway Sandwich.
Our idea was to make a sandwich roll with a lobster in the middle.
So how big is this going to be?
The roll will be about 18 feet long with a 20-foot lobster in the middle of it.
It's pretty big.
Yeah.
Cheryl Pilato is team's coordinator for the U.S. Open Sandcastle Committee. She says organizers expect up to 40 teams to compete on Sunday for more than $20,000 in prize money.
You won't see traditional castles. You'll actually see creatures of art, sculptures that are created by maybe one person that looks like it would have taken 10 or 20 to do. And then you have those that are ginormous and take up the whole 30 by 30 plot. The artistry and the detail that goes into each of their artwork is just amazing.
I can make a claw.
Yeah, make one on that side and we'll make one on this side.
I think we need more water though. This doesn't feel that wet.
The 31st annual U.S. Open Sandcastle Competition features a Saturday children's sandcastle contest followed by the main event on Sunday. For the California Report, I'm Stephanie O'Neill in Imperial Beach.
So is this big enough to practice, or do we want bigger?
I think we need to build some sides up.
Yeah, the sides are pretty big.
Just make a couple metal piles right here. You know, right where the claws are.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Technical producer is Seal Mahler, with additional engineering from Paul Encore and Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Jefferson Beavers, Julia Bernstein, Bridget Bodner, and Nicholas Carpenter. Pat Flynn edited our reports on the prison hunger strikes. The producers are Victoria Malione and Susie Rocho. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.